take a minute and really think back. Now go way back and think about some of your earliest memories of going to school. Were you excited? Were you anxious? Did you worry about what you were wearing, who you were going to talk to, whether it was safe? What do you think in those early days going to school meant for you? Well, in his new memoir, School Clothes, local author and professor Jarvis Givens collects memories of going to school from Black children in America, past and present, and through them finds a common theme that going to school, no matter what that looks like, for Black kids in America was and often still is an act of resistance. He's here in Studio 2. Jarvis Givens is an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Jarvis, welcome.
Thank you.
What's your earliest memory of school?
My earliest memory of school is being dropped off at St. Timothy's Episcopal Day School in Compton, California, which is where I'm from. I remember the first day meeting my preschool teacher. Her name was Mrs. Butterfield. And my mom dropped me off, and she assured me that one of my really close friends who I grew up on the same block with was going to be there later to kind of assure me that I would be okay. But that was really the beginning of a very beautiful journey. I had a wonderful educational experience, but I remember that very first day being dropped off early in the morning at St. Timothy's.
And in your life, when did you begin to become aware that for Black kids in America, and this book really covers, I would argue, you know, roughly 1800s into mid-20th century is the meat of this book,
right,
that there was resistance in that act, that our historic approach to educating Black kids in America was politicized and was a struggle for freedom and power and control all along. When did you first become aware of that?
You know, I didn't become explicitly aware of it until I started studying and uncovering a lot of things about the history of Black education as a graduate student. When I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley, and I remember when I was in undergrad, so many folks would put statistics and sociological studies in front of me about, you know, Black student underachievement, the school to prison pipeline. And it didn't resonate with me because I had always attended high achieving, predominantly Black schools in Compton my entire life, both private and public schools. But when I got to graduate school, I read a book called Their Highest Potential by a woman named Vanessa Siddle Walker, and it was about a very high-achieving Black school in rural North Carolina during the Jim Crow era. And it resonated so much with my own personal experience going to school in these very affirming, high-achieving Black educational spaces. And that was the beginning of my journey to uncover a lot of the important history about Black education before desegregation that I hadn't been informed about, that there was a lot of important empowering narratives of resistance, that, you know, Black education before Brown v. Board of Education was not only a story of separate and unequal, but there were a lot of important cultural resources and political resources and a lot of important leadership development, right? We wouldn't have the leaders of the civil rights movement had they not been cultivated in many of those segregated Black school contexts that I started to study and think more deeply about.
So part of the reason we were intrigued to do this book is that some of the stories that you collect, and you collect a wide range of stories, but some of those come from people who are strong figures in Boston history, whether it's, you know, the poet Phyllis Wheatley, or we just did, a few weeks ago with Carrie Greenidge, her latest book on the Grimsky sisters and the Grimke tree, and Charlotte Fortin Grimke is key in this. When you collected stories from Boston, when you collected stories from Massachusetts, right, we pride ourselves, first public school and, you know, more advanced when it comes to segregation and freedom, et cetera, what'd you learn about us?
I learned that a lot of the politics around race and education in Boston anticipate many of the political struggles that we would see in education in the South decades later, in some cases a century later. So things like the struggles around desegregation and the experiences of Black students in racially mixed school settings.
And to note, if I learned from your book correctly, it was mid-1800s when the Boston area schools were desegregated. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, that is correct, right.
Okay, please go ahead.
Yeah, in the 1850s. Right, and there are waves, right? There are the struggles around desegregation It starts and stops, right, in Boston and in other places as well. But many of the things that we see, for instance, things around disciplining of Black students in the mixed schools settings in the context of Boston were quite similar. The resistance to desegregating schools that we saw happening in Boston were really happening on a much smaller scale than what we would see decades later in many of the southern states. But also the response to efforts to desegregate schools, right? So the firing of Black teachers and the rolling out of those kind of efforts, right? These are similar kinds of patterns that we see in the Northeast, and particularly in Boston, that we would also see in many southern states in the 20th century. But one of the other things that we see is a very kind of active African-American community organizing around educational politics and demanding more for their students. And also this back and forth, right? One of the things that I think is really interesting is that early on in the 1800s, you have Black communities in Boston and in parts of Connecticut as well, actually backtracking and saying, you know what, because of the way that our students are being treated in these mixed schools, we actually don't know if this is the best situation for them. So you have certain segments of the African-American community saying, perhaps better resourced separate schools would be better. So you have this in parts of Connecticut really early in the 1800s, but also in Boston.
So a tension between the push to integrate schools for equal education and those arguing, but when schools are integrated, Black kids don't get an equal education, and perhaps separate resources for schooling Black children in the region would lead to better access to resources and teaching.
Right. So there's this, and it's this back and forth that we see happening, this constant negotiation of power and racial dynamics in the context of schools. For instance, there's a case from Boston where there's a practice in some of the schools. This is in the mid 19th century where, you know, Black students are required to sit in the back of the classroom and misbehaving white students are required to go and sit next to the Black students as a form of punishment. Right. So essentially, in some ways, inferring that you're behaving less than like these people here. Right.
Yeah.
And so as a punishment, you have to go and sit next to them. But the way in which this proximity between Blackness and discipline and punishment is something that we see manifesting in that, you know, case from Boston in the 1850s. Right. But questions around school discipline and punishment and the criminality of, the criminalization of kind of Black students in the contemporary moment, certainly we can trace a through line between those sorts of dynamics.
So a real foreshadowing in Boston earlier of what would come in the South in the late 1800s and into the 1900s, into the 20th century.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you know, the book is School Clothes. And again, we're speaking with Jarvis Givens, who's an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. I want us to take us back to that choice for a minute. And I'm going to ask you to read a little piece from the book. Now, I want to set this up just a little bit. This happens to be from the conclusion, but I promise it's not one of those spoiler type reads, listeners, so that you know. So we've got William Holtzclaw and his siblings, and they're kids. Mm-hmm. And they're set to give an end of year performance, and they're supposed to wear white.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, they live on the grounds of a plantation in Alabama where they work. The family doesn't have white clothes. He goes to bed knowing that there is a debate about what to do in the family. Is that a fair setup?
Absolutely.
Okay. Why don't you pick up where we marked for you from when he gets up?
All right. The next morning, Holtzclaw and his two siblings woke up to white suits for all of them. He was in disbelief at his mother's resourcefulness. She cut up and repurposed the fabric from her only petticoat, a kind of layered undergarment worn beneath Victorian-style dresses to make them flare out at the bottom. She had to be meticulous, cutting the fabric just right to ensure there was enough to cover all three of her children. The petticoat was quite worn, so the fabric was loose. The children would have to be mindful of any big movements, lest they overextend the fabric and cause it to tear. Holtzclaw and his siblings had to adjust to these constraints. Recalling his anxiety about the clothes splitting, he shared that during the performance, quote, "We had to be very careful how we stooped in moving about the stage, lest there should be a general splitting and tearing with consequences we were afraid to imagine," end quote. Knowing this, they carried on with a kind of carefulness. Despite their fears, the clothes held up. It was a proud moment for their family. Holtzclaw's mother and father, both born under slave law, were not permitted to learn. For them, reading and writing would have literally been deemed criminal activity. Seeing their children stand on a platform and perform speeches they learned in school was something like watching a prayer come to life right before their eyes.
And that, again, is Jarvis Givens reading from School Clothes, a collective memoir of Black student witness. So it touches on the clothes. It touches on the pressure for kids being educated in schools, in this case in the South, the denial of education to Black parents who had been in enslavement and then weren't. There's so much there. Why this focus on clothes as a theme? And what do you mean by witness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for that question, and also for selecting such a passage that was really important for me, because in this scenario, the clothing really takes on a metaphorical dimension for me, as it does throughout the entire book. But the focus on clothing became really important for me because I came across so many of these beautiful narratives about Black students dressing up to go to school for the first time right after the Civil War, in the early years of emancipation. And for me, it symbolized something much more than just, trying to look the part, so to speak. But it really was about Black students and families going to school as a way of working to kind of recreate their own identities in the afterlife of slavery, right? Trying to cultivate and support Black students in defining themselves in ways that refuse the ideas about them as less intelligent, right? All of the kind of racialized myths, right, mapped onto Black students' bodies, right? This kind of self-representation in my mind through clothing, right, symbolized something much larger, right? The dreams that they were covered in, right? The prayers that they were covered in, the visions of a new world that they were trying to manifest, the freedom dreams they were trying to manifest in the world. The way that they went to school was kind of aspirational in a particular way that I thought was really important. I felt found to be kind of captured in these stories, like the story of Mary McLeod Bethune when she recalls being a 13-year-old girl and all of the sharecroppers in South Carolina stopping work the day that they go to put her on a train. And she talks about them all gifting her with different articles of clothing for her to go off to this school to kind of become something that they are all hoping that she would be for herself, but also for this kind of larger vision of freedom that Black folks are trying to enact in these first days of emancipation. All right, so that's really what the clothing represents for me. And there were just so many narratives that it became hard for me to avoid. And I wanted to use it because they were both beautiful stories, but also I thought that the language of school clothing took on a kind of a metaphorical dimension that was useful for talking about the stories in the book that I'm offering as a kind of covering for Black students as well, right? In the contemporary moment, but all throughout kind of history, we see Black students inheriting these stories that they're able to use and kind of cover themselves to make sense of the world that they're navigating as a kind of cultural armor, right? And that's how the language of school clothes both as it's kind of reflected in the archival record, in the historical sources, but also the symbolic power that it kind of takes on in the story for me.
So, Jarvis, we have about a minute left, although we could have 10 hours more conversation about this. There's so much more, and we're going to play some music at the end. Singing and song is another piece of this well. Right. But in that last minute, for you, mm-hmm. right, this is marked as a memoir, a collective memoir. What's the story for you now? And what do you want other people to have as the story coming out of reading this book?
That Black students have a very empowering and worthy tradition in education that we can all learn something from, but that is especially an important resource for Black students for their own academic and intellectual identity development, right? That there is a long heritage of education that we need to study to make sense of how power and race operates in the world around us, and that Black students have been bearing witness to that. They've been documenting their experiences, and it's important that we listen to their witness witnessing and take it seriously.
All right. So Jarvis Givens is the author. He's an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. The book is School Clothes, a collective memoir of Black student witness. Worth a read. Incredibly enlightening in terms of the act of witness and resistance that going to school can be. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we are going to go out on Alicia Keys' version of Lift Every Voice and Sing. This was September 2020, posted by the NFL, and we're doing it because the use of this Black national anthem turned out to be a key piece of the work of many schools in educating kids. It's a worthwhile part of the story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston.